Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
That old quote about how those who cannot learn from history are condemned to repeat it? Yeah, we're there. Political Washington is gearing up for another big fight about the debt limit. I know, I'm sorry. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 23rd of May. Good to have you with us. A couple of things to point out about the looming debt limit fight in Washington. Number one, why yes, it has been less than a year since we last dealt with this. Number two, congressional Republicans are once again insisting government spending be cut just as much as the debt ceiling is raised. And number three, boy, the markets hate this kind of stuff. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale gets us going today.
If you think you've heard this before, you have.
Both plans call for tens of billions in cuts.
How about paring entitlements?
The parties are still far apart.
Instead, the GOP seems more interested in a less ambitious deal, one that would center on spending cuts.
This is, as they say, the new normal.
That was the way it sounded on Marketplace last summer, when political brinksmanship over the debt ceiling even caused one rating agency to downgrade U.S. debt. It doesn't sound like politicians have learned any lessons. Here's Speaker of the House John Boehner just last week.
When the time comes, I will again insist on my simple principle of cuts and reforms greater than the debt limit increase.
Laying down the gauntlet on spending cuts or tax reforms isn't starting negotiations off on the right foot for Democrats, like House Budget Committee member Chris Van Hollen.
We should be coming together to try and find a way out, not drawing lines in the sand.
That's right, they're at it again. And this year's negotiations will also have to find a way out of $5 to $7 trillion worth of automatic spending cuts and tax increases if Congress does nothing by January 1st. Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff knows markets and credit rating agencies will be watching even more closely this time.
Just wishing the problem away, holding your breath until the budget gets balanced, doesn't seem like a way to do business.
He says another fiscal showdown risks damaging the already fragile recovery. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As long as we're on debt, let's stay there for a second. What do you say? You got your credit cards, you got your debit cards, and you've got your prepaid debit cards. Parents, for instance, can use them to give their kids plastic, but control their spending at the same time. Banks are getting in on the action as these things become more popular, but there are, of course, hidden fees. So today, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau stepped in. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Prepaid debit cards have traditionally catered to lower-income consumers and people with bad credit.
Everyone is eligible to sign up. You don't even need a bank account.
Now prepaid cards are the fastest-growing method of payment in the U.S., especially for younger Americans. Ron Shevlin is a senior analyst with the Aite Group.
Over the past couple of years, that market has drastically changed. Practically half of today's Gen Yers have a prepaid debit card.
About 7 million of the cards are in circulation in the U.S. The market is about $57 billion and is expected to triple within 2 years. Big banks like Chase are also getting into the market. Greg McBride is a senior analyst with Bankrate.com. He says the cards are profitable.
Just another way for them to fill the revenue hole that's been created by recent regulations.
Limits on the swipe fees banks can charge merchants for credit cards and debit cards don't apply to prepaid cards. And the fees they charge consumers aren't really regulated either, says McBride.
Prepaid cards have traditionally been rife with fees.
A survey from the Consumers Union found prepaid cards often charge hefty fees to customers for checking their balance or even activating the card. Michelle Jun is a senior attorney with the Consumers Union.
The fee structures, they can be changed at any time, and oftentimes consumers won't even know how much the card will cost them until it's too late.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau plans to look into fee disclosure, as well as making sure customers aren't liable for payments if the card gets stolen. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Fans of the Men in Black franchise are already buying tickets for Friday's premiere of installment number 3. Bit of a snag, though. Theaters that are going to show it in 3D don't yet have the glasses you're going to need to see the film in 3D. That's because Sony, the studio, doesn't want to pay for them. Marketplace's Eve Troeh reports this fight is multidimensional.
The tidal wave of 3D really started 7 years ago with Disney's Chicken Little.
Not again! The sky is falling!
The sky kinda did fall, says analyst Charlotte Jones at IHS Global Insight, because Disney shipped 3D glasses along with the film.
And that was seen as encouragement for consumers to adopt this format.
Boy, have we. Every major studio has several 3D films this year. They order cases of glasses for each release and collect them when the movie leaves theaters. In other countries, moviegoers keep the glasses to reuse. But in the U.S., we expect new ones every time.
It's very difficult to suddenly dismantle this system and then pass the buck over to a different party.
The glasses only cost studios about 40 cents a pair. Small change compared to the tens of millions spent on 3D special effects and 3D movie projectors. Analyst Barton Crockett at Lazard Capital Markets says theaters and studios have a gentleman's agreement to split the overall cost of 3D.
You know, when you make a gentleman's agreement, you're opening the door for arguments and disputes and problems.
He says they duke it out movie by movie. With Men in Black 3, Sony's saying, hey, why don't you pick up the glasses this time?
Now all you have to do is jump.
You want me to jump?
Crockett expects Sony to give in and ship glasses in time for the weekend. Will he be in the theater?
I might. My wife kind of likes Will Smith, so we'll see. If we get a babysitter, maybe we'll go see it.
No plans for studios to ship babysitters with their films just yet. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was two-dimensional, down hard, and then up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I have no idea how to set up this next story other than to say I am 100% not surprised that owls aren't the charming pets they seem to be in the world of Harry Potter. How do I know this, you ask? I know because there are reports from the UK that disillusioned wizard wannabes are surrendering the birds that they bought. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is on the owl beat today.
When Harry Potter came out, kids wanted their very own Hedwig.
We do get a lot of requests from people asking us to please sell them an owl because they would like to have one as a pet.
Catherine Redfern is with the World Bird Sanctuary, which breeds owls for release into the wild and for educational facilities. For a while, she says, they were getting a couple of calls a day from people just desperate for a pet owl.
We deflect those very quickly.
For one, it's illegal in most cases to keep native owls in the U.S. You need permits and licenses. Also, owls make terrible pets. Andrew Hume manages the Suffolk Owl Sanctuary in the UK, where owl laws are a little more lenient. He's still not a pet owl fan.
It's not like a domestically bred cat or a dog where it can be trained to go to the toilet. They just naturally go to the toilet full stop.
Owls need a lot of space. They eat whole animals. They live for decades. They sleep when you're awake, make noise when you're asleep, and they have beaks and talons meant to tear flesh and bite through bone.
So they're not going to be cuddled or snuggled?
Susanna Connard is with the John James Audubon Center at Mill Grove. She says owls might also eat your other pets.
He would be your solo companion, absolutely, because you could not have like hamsters or mice or kittens or chihuahuas or anything else, no. No. It would just be prey to them.
But as a Potter fan, I have to ask. Tell me, can an owl deliver a letter for me?
Can they be trained? Yes, but it's a bad idea. Can it deliver a letter? No, it would shred it.
Okay, I'm sold. No owl. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Polls are closed in Egypt now. They're going to open again tomorrow morning to wrap up the first round of presidential elections there. The first ever round of free presidential elections there, I should say. And whoever wins, there are about a dozen names on the ballot, is going to have plenty to do diplomatically, politically, and economically. Amira Ahmed is a journalist in Cairo. We had her on the broadcast last year during the revolution against Hosni Mubarak. So we called her up again today. Amira, it's good to talk to you again.
You too, thanks.
So what's it like today? What's it like out in the streets?
It's undeniably a historic day for Egypt.
there's a sense of excitement, but it's a bit more subdued than we've seen in the parliamentary elections. And the turnout seems like it's going to be a little bit less than the parliamentary elections as well.
What's it like day to day? I mean, as you go about trying to buy a loaf of bread or shop for your groceries, you know, I mean, is it as bad as it was 15 months ago?
The day to day is a little bit different. It's still a struggle. It's still there's that will to change things, but there isn't the ecstasy that kind of was felt during last February and March of 2011 after Mubarak, immediately after Mubarak stepped down.
You know, we see on television here in the States, we see from time to time protests and demonstrations in Cairo. Are people protesting economically now, do you think?
The people have been protesting for economic reasons for years now, and one of the main drivers of the uprising was the economic conditions and was the high rate of unemployment and the social injustice. On the economic front, there hasn't yet been the policy reform that we've seen, that we could see, that could actually bring about any kind of real change when it comes to creating jobs, when it comes to redistribution of wealth. And we've seen that play out in shortages when it comes to butane gas, which people depend on here for heating water and cooking. And we've also seen gasoline shortages with, you know, drivers queuing up for miles to fill up their tank, basically. And we've seen that a lot more frequently than we used to in the past.
Yeah. When was the last time you went out to a cafe or to a restaurant for dinner?
Just a few hours ago, actually, after after I did a little tour of the polling stations.
Yeah. How are the crowds? I mean, are people going out and spending money and you know, doing those things that make an economy go?
Yes. I mean, life is pretty normal for some people if they choose not to be active participants in ongoing protests.
Right. Did you vote today?
I'm going to vote tomorrow. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people have made the same decision learning from the parliamentary election, so I think it's going to be very crowded tomorrow.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes.
Amira Ahmed in Cairo. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Pam and I would show up and go to get our roast corn, and son of a gun, if walking across the plaza, there's Aubrey McClendon getting his roast corn fix.
A down-home oil man and the company he keeps. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it was a rough day to get going. The market swung around, though, in time for the close. The Dow Industrial is basically flat today, down just 6 points. Closed at 12,496. The blue chips were off 190-something at one point. The NASDAQ ticked up 0.4%, 11 points, ended at 2850. The S&P 500 up 0.1%, 2 points, 1318, the number you're looking for. Dell pulled down a batch of tech stocks with a gloomy report on computer demand. Dell lost 17%, its biggest drop since 2000. Microsoft and Intel went along for the ride, each down more than 2%. Apple, though, on the move, up 2.4%. Financial stocks rose. Bank of America added 2.7% today. J.P. Morgan Chase up nearly 0.75%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department will release durable goods for April. In Washington, the Environmental Protection Agency will hold public hearings on carbon pollution standards for new power plants. And 10 students will head to the final round of the National Geographic Bee, moderated by Jeopardy host Alex Trebek. What is Marketplace? I'm Desiree Pena.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was some great news today for Facebook shareholders. The value of their investment rose 3.2%, about a buck. Sadly, that's where the good news ends. There are lawsuits and subpoenas and congressional investigations into the IPO to end all IPOs. It's kind of what happens when there's so much money on the line. But there are some who bought Facebook stock who weren't necessarily financially motivated. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains in our new personal finance segment, Money Matters.
Last week, Karen Dodge bought a single share of stock in Facebook for her 9-year-old daughter.
She has a little piece of history, a little piece of the zeitgeist, and hopefully she'll learn from it.
It's meant to be more of a teaching tool than an investment.
Regardless of what happens to the stock as far as the price, the whole thing is an educational experience for her in what the stock market is.
Not everyone thinks this is the best approach. Stuart Ritter is a certified financial planner with T. Rowe Price.
There are better ways to teach kids about investing and how to achieve their financial goals.
If the stock price rises, Ritter says kids could get the wrong idea.
Then the conclusion could be, hey, you can make quick cash in the stock market. It's about picking hot stocks, and I'm good at it because, look, I already did it.
Then there's the issue of investing in just one stock.
Don't do it.
7-year-old Samantha Ritter explains the risk. If you invest in just one stock and the company performs badly,
the stock will go low and you won't have enough money. So you have to buy two or more.
She means buying stock in two or more companies. Her dad is teaching her about diversification. Karen Dodge says her daughter is in it for the long term.
The stock market is not necessarily a place to make a quick buck, but if you buy a share of Facebook stock initially, you know, 20, 30 years from now, it'll be worth a lot more than it is today.
And even if Facebook flops, she says her 9-year-old is already diversified. She's got a savings account, savings bonds, and gold coins given to her by Grandpa. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There's a decent amount of conversation in this country about the wealth gap. Occupy Wall Street, 1%, the 99%, tax the rich. It's a pretty steady subtext to a lot of the political debate nowadays. Turns out they're having the same conversation over in China, despite or maybe because of the way that economy has been growing the past 20 years. A study out of the University of Southern California earlier this month says Chinese people aren't as happy today as they were a couple of decades ago. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz is on the line from Shanghai with a little bit of context. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So what gives? More money does not equal happiness over there?
No, apparently not. I think what's important here is that this study starts with how happy the Chinese were in 1990. You know, well, back in 1990, China actually operated like a socialist country.
Right.
I mean, most everyone had a job back then. You were either a farmer or you worked for a state-owned company, but the state took care of you. You had lifetime benefits. But what's important to understand is everyone back then had equally dismal pay. It was rare to know anyone who had a lot of money. So in some ways, it was hard to be unhappy because everyone you knew was all in the same boat.
Yeah. And as we now know, that's definitely not the case over there.
No. Today's China is flush with cash. And these days, you can make it rich, but you can also really struggle. And that economic uncertainty impacts how people feel here.
All right. So you went out and you did a little reporting, a little informal, unscientific survey. What'd you find?
Yeah, I went out and talked to a lot of people on the sidewalk about how happy they are with their own economic growth. And the first guy I spoke to is Ray Chen. He's 30 years old, works in an import-export business, born in Shanghai, and he just returned from 6 years in Canada. Now he's back. He wants to marry his girlfriend, but he's still living with his parents. And the only property he can afford is 2 hours away from his downtown office.
I want to buy a house in downtown, but the price is too high. Cannot afford it, actually, right now.
So what are you going to do?
I'm going to stay with my parents, postpone my, marriage with my girlfriend. So we have to stay separately right now.
Yeah, you know, so we talked about that when I was there last year, right?
Yeah.
Everything is becoming more and more expensive. Inflation's a huge problem.
Yeah, everything is rising more than household incomes. And, you know, that's not a good economic formula for happiness.
No, but it is a formula for people making money, though, right? Somebody's making money.
Right. You know, developers are obviously making a lot of money. And of course, the government of China itself is getting rich. And that's something that irks a lot of people I spoke to. You know, in the past 5 years, much of China's economic growth has come from building infrastructure. You know, the party has spent hundreds of billions of dollars on this. And most of these contracts have gone to state-owned companies. So in other words, the government's giving money to itself. So one man I spoke to, Lu Yajou, was really frustrated with this.
Nothing's okay, right? Everything's not all right.
Nothing is okay. And so he's saying that the Communist Party originated from the poor, but now has basically left the poor behind. You know, he's a security guard who makes $5 a day, and he lives in a 30-square-foot apartment with his wife and his daughter, and he isn't happy at all. And so I asked him, I said, how could the government improve the situation in China? And okay, so get this. He said that China should start a war.
No, come on, really?
Yeah. And I said, with whom? And he said, it doesn't matter. He said a war would reduce China's population, which he thought was the country's biggest problem. And this is about as cynical as you can get. But it's not really the first time I've heard this from people here. You know, it's extreme. But I mention it because I think it's evidence that some people on the lowest rungs of the socioeconomic ladder in China are beginning to become desperate about this widening gap between the rich and the poor, and between those who have power and those who don't. And they're really angry about the injustice of it all. And like I said before, this is not a good economic formula for happiness.
Yeah, and you don't hear a lot about those people on the lowest rung, right?
You don't, but they're out there, and as we've heard from Mr. Liu, they're not too happy.
Yeah. Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, guy.
T. Boone Pickens, oil man of long standing and a generally smart energy guy, said this on our morning show the other day.
Natural gas has been a disaster.
Boone was talking prices. Natural gas is about as cheap now as it's ever been. In fact, it's gotten so bad, Pickens has sold his stake in the second biggest natural gas producer in this country, a firm called Chesapeake Energy. But that, to be honest, is the least of Chesapeake's problems. It's got massive debt and growing mistrust among investors. Shares are off 30% since January. And the company's once and future fortunes depend largely on the fate of its outspoken and troubled founder and CEO, Aubrey McClendon of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Marketplace's Scott Tong went out there to learn about the man and his city.
I came to Oklahoma, the land of oil, gas, and profits. What I didn't know is profits here is spelled with a P-H.
In the scriptural sense.
That's columnist Patrick McGuigan at the state capitol, speaking of local visionaries like Aubrey McClendon, the founder of Chesapeake Energy, one of the men who saw the future of natural gas.
They were prophetic in making the shift from coal to natural gas for power generation.
So hear the word of Aubrey McClendon directly. He spoke recently to the TV show Oklahoma Horizon.
It's not just that we have a better product from an environmental perspective. And it's not just we have a product that's domestically made rather than internationally made. It's now about one-tenth the cost of oil.
McClendon may have bet too big on natural gas. But folks here talk of McClendon the man, the philanthropist, the state fair guy. McGuigan and his wife often run into him there.
Pam and I would show up and go to get our roast corn, and son of a gun, if walking across the plaza, there's Aubrey McClendon getting his roast corn fix.
McClendon's other addiction? Pro basketball. At the city arena, the Chesapeake Energy Arena, McClendon is praised for helping lure the Seattle Supersonics to the promised land of OKC, where they're now the Thunder. Fan Tommy Samuel says the team and McClendon have put this place on the map.
It's going to be one of the major cities. So when they get a football team, they're going to be set. Nobody's going to be driving to Dallas no more.
You'd figure McClendon, the part owner, watches from a fancy corporate box.
Oh, come on now. Come on.
Till Mike Turpin corrects me. He's the former state attorney general and a frequent philanthropy partner of McClendon.
They sit in what the Lakers would call the Jack Nicholson seats. They're right there courtside.
Turpin talks of McClendon as a gambler, which is seen here as a good thing if you know your Oklahoma history.
The great Oklahoma land around 1889. Those people were all risk takers looking for a new beginning. We believe in a God of second chances in the great state of Oklahoma.
McClendon ushered in the modern day land grab for energy. His company paid top dollar for drilling rights across the country. It became America's number two natural gas producer. And in the process, it loaded up on debt. Tulsa investor Jake Dollarhide.
They're the riskiest. Absolutely. I mean, that's Aubrey McClendon's style.
He recalls a recent speech by McClendon.
Mr. McClendon took the mic and thanked shareholders. He said, I want to thank you if you've been with us from the beginning. He said, and you know what? Frankly, I'm surprised you're still alive. I'm surprised you haven't had a heart attack because our price has gone to zero at least twice in our publicly traded history.
And down it goes again as the price of natural gas has collapsed. Chesapeake did not protect itself or hedge against low prices. And now it's borrowed billions more to pay its lenders, and it wants to unload prime properties to keep the company going. Energy economist David May.
Chesapeake kind of brought this on themselves by paying too much. From my perspective, everything is related to math. You can't go on forever doing the wrong thing.
On top of that, the feds are looking into potential CEO conflicts of interest. McClendon traded energy futures personally, while the company did too. He and Chesapeake borrowed from the same lenders. But you don't feel tension at the campus of Chesapeake Energy. Workers here throw frisbees at lunch, jog on the spongy blue company track. No one talks on tape, but privately, many affirm their faith in McClendon and his company. Meantime, more big buildings are going up, costing more money. So what happens now? There are whispers of layoffs, contractors not being renewed, vendors being paid late. Inlis won't be surprised if Chesapeake gets bought, or if McClendon quits, or if he indeed turns things around. There's word he just flew to China to find investors. In Oklahoma City, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, just to close the loop on a couple of stories we've been following. As predicted, Hewlett-Packard did indeed announce huge layoffs today, 27,000 people, about 8% of the total workforce. CEO Meg Whitman says it'll save the company something more than $3 billion over the next couple of years. Also, get a load of this. There are reports out today, three or four of them, saying Facebook is talking to the New York Stock Exchange about moving its listing over there after the NASDAQ blew the IPO. That would be kind of an interesting slash big deal. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off just 6 points. We'll call that flat percentage-wise. The NASDAQ ticked up 11 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gained 2 points, 0.1%. Robbie Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.